This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Perfect Dharma, rarely met with even 100,000 million kalpas, having it to see and listen to remember and accept. I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Good morning, everyone. Can you hear me? Okay. Okay, good. Well, it's a beautiful spring day up here at Jikoji. Welcome, everyone, up here to Jikoji. Good to see everyone on Zoom too, from all over, from Columbus to Santa Barbara, down the hill, and up in the bay. Thank you all for being here today. We chanted today the Metta Sutra, and I'm going to read a story from Old Path White Clouds, a portion of a story that talks about metta and love in the many ways that it exists. There was a king, Pasanada, who came to see and speak to the Buddha. And he said this, "Teacher Gautama, there are people who say you advise people not to love. They say you have said that the more a person loves, the more he will suffer and despair. I can see some truth in that statement, but I am unable to find peace with it. Without love, life would seem empty of meaning. Please help me resolve this." The Buddha looked at the king warmly. "Your Majesty, your question is a very good one, and many people can benefit from it. There are many kinds of love. We should examine closely the nature of each kind of love. Life has a great need of the presence of love, but not the sort of love that is based on lust, passion, attachment, discrimination, and prejudice. Majesty, there is another kind of love sorely needed, which consists of loving kindness and compassion, or Maitreya and Karuna. Usually when people speak of love, they are referring only to the love that exists between parents and children, husbands and wives, family members, or the members of one caste or country. But because the nature of such love depends on the concepts of me and mine, it remains entangled in attachment and discrimination. People want only to love their parents, spouse, children, grandchildren, their own relatives and countrymen. Because they are caught in attachment, they worry about accidents that could befall their loved ones even before such things actually take place. When such accidents do occur, they suffer terribly. Love that is based on discrimination breeds prejudice. People becoming indifferent or even hostile to those outside their own circle of love. Attachment and discrimination are sources of suffering for ourselves and others. Majesty, the love for which all beings truly hunger is loving kindness and compassion. Maitri is the love that has the capacity to bring happiness to another. Karuna, thank you, is the love which has the capacity to remove another's suffering. Maitri and Karuna do not demand anything in return. Loving kindness and compassion are not limited to one's parents, spouse, children, relatives, caste members, and countrymen. They extend to all people and to all beings. In Maitri and Karuna, there is no discrimination, no mine or not mine. And because there is no discrimination, there is no attachment. Because there is no discrimination, there is no attachment. Maitri and Karuna bring happiness and ease suffering. They do not cause suffering and despair. Without them, life would be empty of meaning, as you said. With loving kindness and compassion, life is filled with peace, joy, and contentment. Majesty, you are the ruler of an entire country. All your people would benefit by your practice of loving kindness and compassion. The king bent his head in thought. He looked up and asked the Buddha, I have a family to care for and a country to rule. If I don't love my own family and people, how can I care for them? Please help clarify this for me. The Buddha replied, naturally, you should love your own family and people, but your love can also extend beyond your own family and people. You love and care for the prince and princess, but that doesn't prevent you from loving and caring for the other young people in the kingdom. If you can love all the young people, your now limited love will become an all-embracing love, and all the young people of the kingdom will be as your children. That is what is meant by having a heart of compassion. It is not just some ideal. It is something which can actually be realized, especially by someone like you who has so many means at his disposal. But what about the young people of other kingdoms? Well, nothing prevents you from loving the young people of other kingdoms as your sons and daughters, even though they do not dwell under your rule. Just because one loves one's own people is no reason not to love the people of other kingdoms. But how can I show my love for them when they are not under my jurisdiction? The Buddha looked at the king and said, the prosperity and security of one nation should not depend on the poverty and insecurity of other nations. Majesty, lasting peace and prosperity are only possible when nations join together in a common commitment to seek the welfare for all. If you truly want Kosala to enjoy peace and to prevent the young men of your kingdom from losing their lives on the battlefield, you must help other kingdoms find peace. Foreign and economic policies must follow the way of compassion for true peace to be possible. At the same time as you love and care for your own kingdom, you can love and care for other kingdoms. Majesty, last year I visited my family in the kingdom of Sakya. I rested several days at the foot of the Himalayas. There I spent much time reflecting on politics based on nonviolence. I saw that nations can indeed enjoy peace and security without having to resort to violent measures such as imprisonment and execution. I spoke of these things with my father. Now I take this opportunity to share these ideas with you. A ruler who nourishes his compassion does not need to depend on violent means. The king exclaimed, wondrous, truly wondrous. Your words are most inspiring. You truly are the enlightened one. I promise to reflect on all you have said today. I will penetrate your words, which contain so much wisdom. But for now, please allow me to ask one more simple question. Ordinarily, love does contain elements of discrimination, desire, and attachment. According to you, that kind of love creates worry, suffering, and despair. How can one love without desire and attachment? How can I avoid creating worry and suffering in the love I hold for my own children? The Buddha replied, we need to look at the nature of our love. Our love should bring peace and happiness to the ones we love. If our love is based on a selfish desire to possess others, we will not be able to bring them peace and happiness. On the contrary, our love will make them feel trapped. Such a love is no more than a prison. If the persons we love are unable to be happy because of our love, they will find a way to free themselves. They will not accept the prison of our love. Gradually, the love between us will turn to anger and hatred. Majesty, did you hear of the tragedy that took place 10 days ago in Savata because of selfish love? A mother felt she had been abandoned by her son when he fell in love and married. Rather than feeling as if she had gained a daughter, she only felt she had lost her son, and she felt betrayed by him. Because of that, her love turned to hatred, and she put poison in the young couple's food, killing them both. Majesty, according to the way of enlightenment, love cannot exist without understanding. Love is understanding. If you cannot understand, you cannot love. Husbands and wives who do not understand each other cannot love each other. Brothers and sisters who do not understand each other cannot love each other. Parents and children who do not understand each other cannot love each other. If you want your loved ones to be happy, you must learn to understand their sufferings and their aspirations. When you understand, you will know how to relieve their sufferings and how to help them fulfill their aspirations. This is true love. If you only want your loved ones to follow your own ideas and you remain ignorant of their needs, it is not truly love. It is only a desire to possess another, an attempt to fulfill your own needs, which cannot be fulfilled in that way. Majesty, the people of Kosala have sufferings and aspirations. If you can understand their sufferings and aspirations, you will be able to truly love them. All the officials in your court have sufferings and aspirations. Understand those sufferings and aspirations, and you will know how to bring them happiness. Thanks to that, they will remain loyal to you all their lives. The queen, prince, and princess have their own sufferings and aspirations. If you can understand these sufferings and aspirations, you will be able to bring them happiness. When every person enjoys happiness, peace, and joy, you yourself will know happiness, peace, and joy. That is the meaning of love according to the way of awakening. This is from Old Path, White Cloud. The chapter on love is understanding. So today we also chanted the Metta Sutra, which talks about not holding the fixed views and how that fixity to holding to views can really limit us. It's hard to find understanding when we hold to fixed views. And there's part of this practice that we're in is one of refining our lives, refining the way we function, refining how we respond to things. And there's many ways to go about dealing with that. And of course, in our practice of this Soto Zen practice, Zazen, or sitting meditation, is one of the core elements to it. And we come to sit, and you might ask why. And I think that's a fair question that everyone here probably wonders, why would one meditate, but it must be good, and so I do it, and it feels good, and I want to know more. So there's an element of curiosity and deliberation in this, and exploration in this effort to, in this practice, in this meditation practice that we do. When we sit to be with ourselves, it gives us the opportunity to see how we are, see how our breath rate is, see how our, might even feel our heart beat. We can sense the strength of our posture and the quality of our being. And this turning our attention inward to this ourselves gives us that chance to become grounded in how our being is at this moment. And this grounding, this ability to connect to our being in a way that it shows us things. It shows us not only the quality of our breath and the quality of our being in this moment, it shows us what's on our mind, what's coming up, and it's surprising sometimes. And the more you sit and do this meditation, the more surprised you will be. And through these many surprises also come insights. Because when you're surprised, you get the chance to see something about how one's mind is, how our mind is, that is actually liberating for a moment. Little by little, we liberate ourselves. And so this practice we do regularly, every day if we can. For a few minutes, even just in a day, or longer if that works too. But to have the chance to turn our attention inward, and turning our attention to our breath is a way of turning it inward, gives us a chance to check the regulated quality of our being and see how our day is unfolding, how our life is manifesting, and what comes up on our mind. So there are ways to deal with what comes up on our mind, but it requires noticing what comes up. And so it seems like in order to notice what comes up on our mind, usually this meditation gives us a better opportunity to get a grander view of what's coming up on our mind than the more intimate way that it does in a day when the confusions hit us and the sounds abound and we're suddenly immersed in this, what am I going to do? So taking the time to actually give some distance provides a gap or a greater vista of how we function. And it gives us possibilities of what we can do next. So in our lives, there are, we hopefully work towards wholesome ends. with wholesome means. It's sometimes helpful to hear a list of some of the unwholesome things and wholesome things to see, because they kind of show us how we are doing. There's, in the discourses of the Buddha, there's a sutra called the Sutra of Effacement. Now, to efface is to rub away, to thin away obstacles, to make them, the obstacles disappear. And each of us has obstacles in our lives. And so to, for example, we make choices when we encounter these obstacles. And I won't go through the entire list, but some of them are like, others will kill living beings. We shall abstain from killing living beings here. Others will take what is not given. We shall abstain from taking what is not given. This is from the Sutra on Effacement. Others will speak falsehood. We shall abstain from false speech here. Others will speak maliciously. We choose to abstain from malicious speech here. Others will gossip. We shall abstain from gossip. And it goes on for the ways of being covetous, instead choosing to be non-covetous, to have, some may have wrong intention, and we will work to have right intention, right effort, right mindfulness. Some may be deceitful, and we will not be deceitful. We do not practice being deceitful here. Some may be obstinate, but we will practice to not be obstinate or arrogant. Some may be difficult to admonish, but we shall be easy to admonish here. That's a tough one. To welcome criticism. Some wish to have bad friends. We shall have good friends here. Surrounding ourselves with good people really helps us along the way. Some may be negligent and faithless or shameless, and we will be negligent. We will not be negligent. We will be faithful and can feel shame. It's odd that shame is something we don't want to feel, and yet it is helpful if we actually allow ourselves that. For those who feel no shame also may feel no blame, and it's how can we adjust how we function as we operate unless we can sense the horsewhip, sense the shame, sense the raw feelings of blame. I wanted to talk a little bit more about the last one, which is some want to adhere to their own views, hold on to them tenaciously, and relinquish their views with difficulty. We shall not adhere to our own views or hold on to them tenaciously, but shall relinquish them easily. And that relates to this not holding the fixed views. It's you can have that intention to not hold on tenaciously to a view, but it's, you almost have to be hit with your view that you're holding it on too tightly to know that maybe you could hold it slightly differently. And what Thich Nhat Hanh suggested in this reading of the ways of considerate love is through understanding, that when we understand more deeply the conditions that are arising in the situations we're in, take the time to create the space to look at that situation, then with that understanding, our views are more easily relinquished or adjusted or expanded. So in our practice of wholesome efforts, we choose to incline our mind in a certain direction. And we learn to abstain from unwholesome, unhelpful activities. And this is just an ongoing practice we do all our lives. We experience how wholesome actions help our path and help others' path. And through our efforts, the unwholesome are extinguished or effaced. Through this practice of meeting ourselves regularly, daily, through our daily meditation and through intensive maybe meditation practice, which we offer here too, we can come to know our core intention, our core values. We come to, at first they might not be so tangible or definable, but the more we sit, we actually can come into close contact with our core intention. And that is helpful in the determination that we apply to this life. Jikoji at this time is a lay practice center. There are other monastic centers around, but we have chosen this way. This is what works here now, lay practice. And that means that we're not as strict as a monastery would be. Our rules are at a minimum. We are flexible in our view of how we hold these rules. And that makes it more welcoming for the many ways that we all come here with all the different conditions of our paths we've each been on. The homes we come from, the cultures we grew up in, the locations where we were, the modes of operating that we learned and unlearned and relearn in our life. This gives us a chance to welcome being a lay practice center, all peoples that want to do what we do here. Not so strict. We are sashins that we hold here. We welcome people to come for any or all of a sashin. We welcome that. And that is was a directive from our founding teacher, Koban Chino Roshi. He believed it was important to welcome people when they showed up. And I don't know if others of you have gone to other sashins where you're required to be at every sit, or you're required to show up on time, and if you don't, you sit in another room. We welcome people when they show up, and it creates a different feeling and environment here. Any path that any of us are on can lead to awakening. Any path. When we fall in the ways of desire, anger, delusion, our way may take longer and much longer to develop a useful practice. And so it's just helpful to be reminded from time to time of ethical and moral conduct. We have the Eightfold Path, right effort, right view, right thought, right livelihood, right action, right meditation, right concentration. We have the three pure precepts. I vow to end all evil. I vow to practice every good. I vow to be with all beings. It's kind of like the golden rule. And it's, remembering these things help us be more noble in our practice. And that's what this practice is. It's a noble practice to take this pose and sit and do this meditation. It is a noble practice that brings the wholesome qualities that we want in our life to be here now. When we bring these wholesome qualities, it penetrates not only our existence, but the area around us and those we work and live with. We find our way is supported by, you can call it a fabric of existence, the interconnected, interdependent ways. Fabric has a weave going in different directions, but it's almost two-dimensional. So a brocade might be a more hardy fabric to consider how this existence is supported by all these different ways. We find our way supported by the brocade of the teachings, of the practices, of the Sangha, and of teachers. So sometimes it's helpful to have a teacher that you connect with. When we misstep, we can still find our way. And actually, when we misstep, we find ways that are not so helpful, paths not to go down. We may choose to go down it, we may need to go down it to join another friend partway down the path, but missteps are essential in this, because with each misstep, if you notice it's a misstep, comes an insight. That was a misstep. And every insight, they start to add up. There's no place where these insights go to be, if you put your insights into a bag that you get to carry, are they located someplace in your head? Are they located in the body or in your bank account? The insights, they accumulate. But the tendency is that when you have an insight, one insight, it's not a singularity. You're going to have a second insight and then many more. And as the insights happen, they actually become more regular. So it's kind of fun. The way develops by how we help, by how we can help, and how we do help. And sometimes it is most helpful to just get out of the way. Sometimes it's lending a hand or giving a lift. Sometimes it's giving an ear to deeply listen. But the path requires us to listen deeply to the sounds and moods around us. And this listening includes not only hearing, but seeing and feeling and smelling and touching the world as it is. The world as it is that we can tangibly touch is called the world of form, rupa. And rupa can have shape and form, and it can also have, as matter, density and vast densities, like mountains and planets and stars. But there's also another thing that supports us, which is, it's called, it's often paired like form and emptiness. Emptiness can also be, it's not empty of substance, it's empty of a unique permanent self. It's emptiness is also boundlessness, because the breath that each of us takes is directly connected to the boundlessness of this atmosphere we're immersed in. The mind that we're in contact with in this world is connected to the vast open mind of existence that extends to all places in the universe. The vessel, we are vessels. And much like a vase is open, or a jar is open to the air, do you say that the air in the jar is confined, or is it connected to all air? And if a jar breaks, the air of the jar still is the same air. So the form and emptiness, form and boundlessness, it's all indicates the interconnected, interdependent potential of patterns, processes, the archetypes that exist. We often wonder, how do I find the path for me? How do I find my path? And really the first place to start is to connect to your breath. And when you connect to your breath, then the rest is revealed. Through observing our difficulties and fears from this seat of awareness, we can see the conditions and causes of what is before us. And even the troubling conditions before us can illuminate our practice, like the COVID virus has done over these last many years. The virus shows how interconnected we all are, the interbeing of this existence. When we fear, we isolate. And fear leads to doubt, suspicion, and sometimes anger that leads to hatred. What we are perceiving, our perceptions are governed by our predilections, our preferences, our prejudices. And through this practice of observing ourselves and our mind, we're able to more easily meet reality as it is. So I want to close with a brief poem from one of the other teachers here at Jokoji. Paula Jones. This poem is titled ghost towns. What a wasteland, these ghost towns. I miss where I came from. Once I picked up a stone to throw at a local fool. A fool for love. But my hand shook even then. I should have ducked. So thanks for listening, and I'd like to open it for questions, comments, criticisms, anything? Yes, hi Larry.
Yeah, thank you. I was taken by your comments on understanding, and I planned to be able to be present to the other, and I turned it around and standing under. So if I'm standing under their pain, if I'm in solidarity with them, my false notions will be gone.
Your false notions will be gone.
If I stand under it, I'm carrying their load, helping. So that just struck me.
Yes. It's valuable how you presented that understanding you're under, and in a way then taking on a load, stepping into their shoes.
Mm-hmm.
Helping them carry their load. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Larry. Yes.
Hi. It's possible I may have heard that analogy of the vessel, but I think you just made it really clear about the vessel and the emptiness and connected to all air. It's a very simple concept, but it was a really very insightful, just a very simple metaphor for what is it, emptiness versus warmth. I really liked that. Very simple.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. She asked, commented on the idea of a vessel open to the boundless air and how it's helpful. We talk about Buddha nature, and in a way it sounds like something particular, but it might be more helpful to just call it open mind. That's we're all directly connected to. So how can you not be connected to it except by having all these layers of notions that we carry? So thank you for your comment. Yes?
I was going to ask a question about love as understanding. That it was really compelling to hear the description. I'm wondering if there are places in our life where we see that we're not exhibiting that, but we would like to. Do you have recommendations, or is there anything you suggest around how to move towards that?
How we can recognize that we're lacking understanding, or in order to better function in a way of compassion or loving kindness.
Yeah, or maybe after you have the recognition, how to move more towards the loving kindness.
It might be different for everybody, because some people intuitively can quickly go to saying, I got a deep understanding, even though you don't have to identify all the particulars of that understanding. It's like you get it. Like one of our Sangha members mentioned that when his niece could sense his unhappiness. She didn't have to understand his unhappiness. She just came over and saw it and gave him a hug. It's that. So I don't know, sometimes it takes time to figure it out how to deepen our understanding, but looking at the causes and conditions of a situation is helpful. Because usually we're looking at how we see a situation is unfolded, and so our understanding is limited to that. And usually everyone operates from a base of good intention. So if there might be some people that operate malevolently, but is it, or do they see it that they're actually operating with good intentions? So it's like when we can change how we open it up some, then our understandings are going to deepen. And it might take time. It might take sitting down, facing the wall, spending some time with it to... sometimes it's hard when someone is a jerk time and time and time again. How do you say, well, I have a fixed view. You're a jerk. And so, if you see this particular person actually engage in a kind activity, one's view of that person might actually change and be more generous. So how do we become more generous? That's pretty important too. And there's no one way. It's just, we each got to figure it out. That's the thing about this practice, is we each have to do it ourselves and figure it out. But it's helpful to come together and have conversations with friends, with teachers, with colleagues, with the woods, with just silence. Many ways. Do you have any other ideas on this?
I mean, metta meditations are coming to mind, or sort of very specific things, but just hearing your talking around the area was helpful. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Larry?
I'm just wondering if understanding isn't more a work of the heart than it is a work of the head.
It's both. I think it's both. That's what meditation is for, because you have to know yourself, know who you are, what kind of negative thought or positive thought you have, in order to change, to get to a better understanding. So we can. That's what I think. Well, because I'm basically Buddhist at heart, but that's how I'm raised. But in the traditional Buddhism, they don't emphasize meditation. But now the modern way to apply Buddhism in our life is through meditation. Mm-hmm. Because then we understand ourselves better.
Mm-hmm.
And talking back about understanding, I think understanding help us in the way that we don't judge other people.
Mm-hmm.
That way it makes life easier for both, for mm-hmm. ourselves and the other person.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, when I come here, I knew about those things, but the way you present it, I think that's why I think meditation is very good.
Yeah. And Larry's point about that understanding comes from the heart. You know, when we talk about heart mind as bodhicitta, heart mind. So maybe understanding, when it starts from the heart, then it opens up how the mind responds to it too. Instead of like, well, I'll understand this out. But really, it's helping the heart first. Yeah. Thank you. Okay. So, hi, Chris. Yes.
Hello, Doug. Thanks for your talk. Let's see. This kind of goes back to your story to some degree. I was wondering if you had a suggestion. It seems to me that when we get involved in strong feelings of love, either for your group or your family or a romantic love, it's really easy. I can see the pitfalls of getting attached to the object of that. And on the other hand, if you kind of, to avoid that, if you become more stoic and just kind of a little bit at arm's length, that doesn't seem like a really good way to go either. So my question is there a way of detaching from the object of your love and then retain the power and the energy of that passion that you had without tying it to that particular object of the love? Does that make sense?
Yes, thank you, Chris. That so you're saying that perhaps these passions for love are helpful.
Seems like there's a lot of energy there that you don't want to just close yourself off to, but it's not helpful to attach to the object of it. So is there a technique or a suggestion of how to retain the power of that, the energy of that, without becoming attached to the object?
Well, maybe you just answered it by not attaching to the object of love. Just letting go of that attachment, the objectness of it. Because an object implies an other, a thing, a self. And maybe the relinquishing of the objectness of it gives it its interconnected ties to all things. And it that gives a broader way in which to respond, maybe still with passion. Do you have anything in particular, particular example?
Yeah, I mean, there are times when I feel like I just tend to go the more kind of like more a more stoic route. Rather, if I sense myself becoming too connected to a person, usually a person or anything that invokes that in me, I tend to kind of push it away because I notice that I'm becoming attached in a way that I'm not comfortable with. And then as your story pointed out, that usually eventually that person will inevitably disappoint us or our expectations aren't met or whatever it is. And it becomes something other than pure unconditional love, which is what we're hopefully striving for.
Yeah. Holding on to the passion of our love for another or a situation then really confines our options and confines the other person as well.
Yeah.
That can then lead to disappointment. So I think it's, we just have to look at the kind of love that we have and see if it's, how personal it is, how based in understanding it is. We just have to look at it and live through it and value whether check it out, whether it feels wholesome or it doesn't feel wholesome, whether it's suffocating or liberating, and then navigate those passages through the way we take our steps forward and take, occasionally take missteps, and backtrack and correct our the path we're on. So.
Thank you.
Sorry, Karen.
Yeah, I had an additional comment on what the question that was asked, and that what I've realized in myself is that one of the mistakes we can make is to take the teachings to be absolute truth and not experiencing them ourselves and not like going through the process ourselves, like as we chanted earlier, that I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words. And so if we take attachment as bad from the get-go without experiencing it as bad or seeing it as bad, then we have the tendency to do the spiritual bypass that I am attached and so it is bad, so I shouldn't be attached. Or like passion is bad and I shouldn't be passionate. And so, I guess I just wanted to appreciate that comment that like it is what I've noticed in myself is valuable to accept what, like neither accept or reject what you have, but see what you have and get a taste of how it is like.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, directly experience our attachment, our passion. And then we get to live with it for a while and see how it tastes, what the real flavors of it are, and then how problematic or not it is. And yeah, it's an exploration, isn't it, each time? Yeah, yes?
I'm very new to meditation and Buddhism, so I'm very confused at certain points. So you mentioned that attachment is bad because that may lead to disappointment and pain and suffering if the person does disappoint you or like betray or hurts you in some sense. So I'm not exactly sure what attachment means. And also another question is, if you love someone and you don't want to be attached because you're afraid of pain and suffering later, how could you call that true and unconditional love? And what is true and unconditional love anyway?
Wow.
Yeah.
Many lifetimes.
Yeah. I think attachment, you wonder what attachment is. And I think, as Karen mentioned, it's something we have to explore what it is. When we have a relationship with someone that we begin to like, we say, "Wow, this is fun. I'm getting attached. Is it going to work out again to spend time?" And so you get to explore that, and then pretty soon you get to see how your mind is reacting to different risings of circumstance, that then I think it becomes clear, this is an infatuation. I've been through this before. This doesn't feel so good. Or there's some expectations I have here and they're not being met. So I'm attached to those expectations. And so you're finding out what attachment is in that for you. As far as unconditional love, and what it is, I mean, there are all these different kinds of love we need to experience in our life, because unconditional love for a lover is one thing maybe that you want to aspire to, but the passions of love are also delightful. And so you take best care of them, and hopefully the kind of love that arises makes the unity of bigger than the two independently. It becomes like, wow, this is vast. And the realm of play becomes pretty interesting.
So it seems like something just came to my mind while you were explaining. So it sounds to me that attachment is when, from your perspective, could be when your love is selfish, it's not for the unity of both people. Then you have insecurity and you have all these expectations and you don't truly understand the other person. And to me, it seems like when you truly love someone and when your love is unconditional, you could have a deep connection with the person, and that seems to be different from the attachment you were talking about, that people should abandon, which cause pain and suffering. So it's like, to me, I feel it's okay to truly love someone and have like a great connection instead of attachment.
Yes, and trust is an important element there. Oh, like,
thank you.
If to me, for me, in a loving situation where I totally trust the intentions and actions of the other person, irrespective of what happens, I just trust that they are going to do the best, take best care for them, for all beings, for and if I'm offended, that's my problem. But it's like they're taking best care, and then it seems like things flourish. But trust is another element. There are all these parts to it, you know, that makes it what it is. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May I say? I'm sorry. May I say? I'd like to add. When you're connecting with someone, it's very helpful to see them as if you're seeing them for the first time, every time. For the first time, every time. That way, you don't have a connection to, oh, this person acts this way. You know, it just drops. You're seeing them anew each time, because we're all different at every moment.
Thank you.
That's good.
I'm just wondering, doesn't a love that is true push out a love that is false?
Nice way to put it. Yeah. Jennifer, would you like to? Hi.
How's that? Better? I had a thought. You mentioned the vessel or the jar, and that what's inside the jar, the air, is the same as the outside. So I'm thinking that is what's in the jar is what's outside the jar is, and the vessel just separates. Is our ego the vessel? And do we break the vessel? Do we break the ego? We always want to put our ego and the vessel back together. We want it to be there. It's like we want that separation of what is inside and outside the vessel. But it sounds like we need to break that vessel, break that ego, so we have it all. There is should be no separation, right? So to have that vessel sounds like we're better off breaking our vessel, breaking the ego, so we can be understand what is, and there is no separation. Is that kind of the goal of our meditation, to do that?
Yes and no. So the yes part is we break the vessel by seeing our interconnectedness with all things, and then our self, the fixity of our self dissolves. But then we take another breath and another step, and it's like, I'm getting cold. I am getting cold. I need to put a jacket on. And I need to take care of this vessel. We need to take care of the vessel. So we need our ego. We need that self. We need that self-awareness to keep going, to keep it fluid, to keep it healthy, to keep, in order for us to keep being useful and helpful to other people, other situations. So I think in our meditation, that gives us a chance to break the vessel or have it dissolve, the fixity of what we imagine the vessel is in our mind, to break it. Because as Judy just said, every moment we are different. And each one of us here is different each moment. So if you can recognize that each moment we're different than we were the previous moment, then the fixity of self, of the vessel, becomes more porous, like it naturally is.
I'm going to visualize my vessel as being different then, rather than a fixed jar. I need to see that vessel as being more porous and more flowing, maybe. And I guess that I can see that visual better for me, for my ego. Okay.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. Good. Thank you for helping clarify that. That's helpful to many, including me. Thank you.
There's a question over there.
There's another one? Yes. Hi.
Yeah. The thing that stood out to me was in the story when the Buddha was talking to the wise king, the jealous mother who was very attached poisoned her son and her daughter-in-law. My question, how does a son or daughter create a healthy distance from a jealous family member while still preserving peace and family?
Did people online hear that? His question was related to the story of the mother, the jealous mother who poisoned the son and daughter-in-law, and how does one create a healthy environment so that it works?
I would say that it's kind of a dance.
A dance. It's a dance. It's fluid dance. And sometimes you get out of the way, and sometimes you the boundaries keep shifting. So, yeah, that notion of dance or fluidity is helpful in that situation. But does that help? Do you have any idea, any other comment about that, or notion on how to make it work?
My theory is that the key is perhaps separation.
Separation.
Yeah. But I'm wondering if there is a true answer.
Well, there are probably different boundaries that can be established that are kindly set, and that changes too, helps to change. And one of the boundaries we're encountering is time. the cook is saying things are ready. So thank you everyone for being here.
Our intentions equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's ways. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Illusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. The Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.
Okay, we can leave the room as it is, and let's go up to...
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.